Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
We are moving toward the politics of nostalgia, as if we could move away from a globalized world. We want the benefits of globalization, but we want to live in our own village. Traditional distinction between domestic politics and international politics is disappearing. The nice garden that Europe is cannot survive if it doesn't have the power to influence the jungle around. We should work in the future for a system in which Russia has a privileged relationship with the European Union. The UN didn't fix the Cold War, and the UN is not going to fix the relations between the superpowers of today.
G'day. Welcome to the National Security Podcast. I'm Chris Farnham, and this is the podcast that looks at the national security challenges facing Australia and the Indo-Pacific. This podcast is brought to you by Policy Forum and the National Security College at the ANU. And with most pods lately, we bring you this one as the world seems to be going to hell in a handbasket. Since our last podcast, we have seen Iranian special forces board a British flagged vessel transiting international waters in the Persian Gulf. They have taken control of the vessel, they have parked it in Iranian waters, and they have raised the Iranian flag on this vessel. This is unarguably retaliation for the Brits commandeering an Iranian tanker accused of flouting international sanctions, and now the Brits are sending more vessels to the Gulf to protect their shipping. We have seen President Trump show some of his cards in terms of election strategy, and they seem to have the word race written all over them. The president has accused four Democratic candidates, all women, mind you, whose ethnicities are not European based, of being anti-American and suggesting that they, and I say in air quotes, go back to where they came from. This resulted in a large rally in North Carolina chanting, "Send them back." President Trump has since tried to distance himself from the chant after a strong backlash against its inherent racism, but has since doubled down on the "they hate America" rhetoric, which seems to indicate that part of his re-election strategy will focus on these women, at least during the Democratic primaries, and try to rally a core of nationalistic right-wing voters with divisive and racist tropes. Identity politics is alive and strong in the US. And just as I walked into the studio to record this intro, news is breaking that South Korea has fired warning shots at Russian aircraft who may have violated Korean airspace. And one would assume that they did not respond satisfactorily to the Koreans when they were challenged. And what a wonderful segue all this is into today's podcast, where we speak with Jean-Marie Gernot about geopolitics, Europe's relationship with the world, identity in a globalised yet fragmented world, and the future of national defence. Today, Jean-Marie is a distinguished fellow at the Brookings Institution, where he focuses on foreign policy. But before his time with Brookings, Jean-Marie was Director of Policy Planning at the French Ministry of Foreign Affairs. He was Head of Peacekeeping Operations at the United Nations, and he was also CEO of the International Crisis Group, among numerous other leading roles within public and private life. Jean-Marie has published widely, including a number of books, and is currently penning another with the working title of The Second Renaissance, where he looks at the flows of culture, identity, geography, and technology, and what kind of a world is likely to emerge as these and other trends interact and intersect. Jean-Marie has some interesting and pretty surprising takes on the world today and where it may go in the future. So let's hear from him right now. G'day Jean-Marie, welcome to the National Security Podcast. Thank you for joining us today, and I would like to start off asking you a question based on your career trajectory. You've worked in the private sector, you've served in leadership roles within national government in the pursuit of the national interest. Since then, you've moved on to supranational government at the United Nations, and then to non-government organisations and think tanks with organisations such as the International Crisis Group and Brookings. How does a transition like that influence your thinking about government, security, and the world in general?
Well, I think in today's world, international relations are managed by many more actors than governments. Domestic affairs, international affairs, they're all interconnected. And so for me, moving to from one level to the other was a very good experience in understanding the world as it really is. National government is interesting, but you very quickly find that the national interest is nothing if it is not combined with a broader interest. And so I was very happy to serve the United Nations because I felt there I could serve a broader global interest that would in the end also serve my own country. And then moving on to the International Crisis Group, an organization founded by Gareth Evans. Moving on to the International Crisis Group, I felt that this was a position of influence. I had felt it when I was at the UN, a consumer of the products of the International Crisis Group. But I felt running it that I could contribute to the international debate and to the debate in the countries afflicted by countries. Very often those countries, they don't have good think tanks, they don't have a good press. And so what they learn from a good report of the International Crisis Group is really helps them shape the debate. And if you don't understand your own country, how are you going to change it for the better?
Yeah, talking about countries and the way they see themselves, we've seen a rise in presidentialism, which in other words may be framed as populism, or a very different style of leadership in international governments, usually personified by President Trump or Rodrigo Duterte in the Philippines and so on. And we're seeing this rise of nationalism and populism and presidentialism throughout Europe and many different countries. What do you think is driving this change, and where do you think it's leading the world?
Well, I think it's reflective of a crisis of politics. I think more and more people have a sense that governments are not in control. So when they read the program of a political party, they are not convinced. And so they then believe in the politics of identity. When they elect Trump, they elect a billionaire because they believe that maybe they will too become a billionaire. They will be a billionaire by sort of delegation, so to speak. I think that's very dangerous because I think it kills what is the essence of democracy, which is the debate, which is a discussion of ideas. And if you just identify with individuals, you run the risk of illiberal democracy and eventually dictatorship. So I think we have to restore politics, but restoring politics means restoring a sense of control, a sense that you can impact events, that you're not just run by them. And in this globalized world where no country, even the most powerful countries, can go alone, it is difficult because it means connecting different levels, different operational levels, from the city to the country to global institutions. And today there is a fear that global institutions, instead of helping manage globalization, they are the Trojan horse of globalization that will infringe on your sovereignty, that will infringe on your freedom of action. And so the politicians, I think, have a hard time convincing their constituents that they have a role to play.
Yeah, you've mentioned a couple of trends there. You've mentioned globalization. You've mentioned connectivity around the world. And that's not just connectivity of people, say, over the internet, but there's connectivity of economies and also populations where we're seeing large people movement. So there is this greater interconnectedness throughout the world, but we're also seeing greater fragmentation as well, both in identity and in also the way we see communities facing this change. And we're also seeing the rise of ethno-nationalism and so on. These are essentially two competing forces that don't sit with each other. How do you see the future of the idea of globalization when we see this kind of incongruence of interconnectivity but also fragmentation?
Well, I think the two, in a way, are paradoxically connected. I think after the end of the Cold War, there was a kind of triumphalism, a sense of that the individual had agency, that every individual could change the world. And now you have the opposite feeling. You have the feeling that the individuals, they are lost in a world that is much bigger than them. And so they are looking for borders. They are looking for a sense of their own their own limits. They want to live in a self-contained community. So that's why we are moving toward the politics of nostalgia, so to speak, as if we could move away from a globalized world, which provides enormous benefits. If we had to produce all the things we consume in countries that have high standard of living, well, we couldn't afford them. It would be much more expensive. We believe that we want to have our cake and eat it. We want the benefits of globalization, but we want to live in our own village. And that is not possible. We need to accept that our village is connected economically, intellectually, politically to the rest of the world. That doesn't mean that our identity is going to disappear, but that means that we have to manage it within different circles.
And so there's also different levels here, because there's also different vulnerabilities, and we're talking about also defense. And I'm just going to read a pretty amazing quote from some of your written work. I'll put the link up on our website, but this really struck me when we look at the way the world is interconnected and some of the vulnerabilities that come for open societies as well. So I quote you here, where you say, "The only way to restore some symmetry and stability is to organize defense at the lowest possible level, empowering individuals to protect themselves against cyber attacks through point-to-point encryption, and empowering cities to strengthen legal connections among its citizens, making it more difficult for outsiders to launch attacks. Devolving power to individuals and to lower levels of government will also deprive enemies of targets whose value resides in their symbolic value as centers of great power, reducing the advantage of asymmetric attack. Nuclear warfare, but also cyber warfare, will be less likely if there is no target of strategic importance." So that's a really interesting and forward-looking way, the way societies can defend themselves. But it's also somewhat devolving the power of the state. How do you see the trend lines evolving of how individuals can protect themselves and how communities can protect themselves?
I think we have two trends that seem to go in opposite direction but have to be reconciled. On the one hand, I think small is getting more and more beautiful. I think people want the comfort, the proximity of their city. Maybe a big city, but their city, because they see that as something that can be accountable, that they can have control over. And I think in terms of security, they see that a resilient society is a society which works in networks. And so we are moving from a kind of pyramidal order in which the bigger you were, the stronger you were, the safer you were, to a networked order in which a multitude of nodes mean that you are much more resilient, because if one node is put out of commission, you have all the other nodes that's still working. So that trend really pushes toward smaller entities, both for reasons of identity and for reasons of resilience. At the same time, you want interoperability. You want all those nodes. They're not going to be isolated islands. That wouldn't work. That would be terrible. You need the connections, and you need institutions to manage the connections, to manage norms that allow all these nodes to work with each other. And that's what I think is complicated. and where we are still finding our ways. Because I see the world 30 years from now as in some ways much more decentralized than today's world, but at the same time with institutions, structures, which will not be world government. I think people don't want that, and I think it's a utopia, and it's a dangerous utopia, but where we will see institutions that allow that decentralized level to connect with each other through shared norms, and what kind of institutions will provide for the accountability and the connectivity between those different levels. That is not the typical federalism, because typical federalism is purely geographic, while probably the federalism of tomorrow will be much more functional. And so you will have different functionalities carried, managed through different institutions. And that's something that in a way is beginning to appear. We see specialized organization that run the internet. The problem is that those organizations, what is their accountability? That's something that really needs to be improved. So you will see functional organization that combine a political dimension with sometimes a corporate dimension, non-governmental dimension. But I think the political institutions of tomorrow, in a way, will replace a nation state as we have seen it since the 17th century. We are at the end of a very long cycle, and we don't know exactly what the institution of tomorrow will look like, but I'm pretty convinced they will be very different from today's institutions.
And so you've partly answered this question already, but I'm going to put it to you because I think that there's more we can pull out here. A lot of what you're talking about when you mention these networked cities and the way that people interact with each other is based on technology. And a lot of this technology is changing very rapidly and in ways that make it impossible for us to predict how it's going to impact us as societies. How do we decide what principles we base the use of this technology and the development of this technology on? How do we assure that there is comprehensive adoption of these principles in a way that doesn't benefit defectors?
Well, I think you're probably going to see a competition of norms, and that will be a good thing. You will people are on the move today. They are on the move sometimes because of poverty, wars. They're also on the move because of opportunities. I think for the future of freedom, if one believes in freedom, it's very important to have different options. And you probably will have hopefully different systems, different systems of values competing with each other and living with each other with enough commonality that they can interact with each other, but nevertheless different. And maybe you will see people moving to the system that best suits them. What worries me in tomorrow's world is that I think that with the development of artificial intelligence, in particular, you will have different classes of citizens, so to speak. You will have a top layer which will see artificial intelligence as a booster, and which will boost its own influence with artificial intelligence, and you will have a lot of people who may be, in a way, redundant. there will be enough resources to feed them. There might even be the capacity to keep them happy with what I would call preventative dictatorship. That is, you don't work on repression. You work on making sure that people go to the websites that reinforce the views you want them to have, that kind of thing. But then you lose the human initiative. And maybe we are reaching that stage. But I think the beauty of the human destiny has been the people's curiosity, has been the desire always to go further. And a system that would develop, and sometimes a bit worried that China could be on that way, on that, in taking that direction, a system where people would fundamentally be happy but would lose the sense of questioning because the government will provide, in a way, for their happiness, will make it unnecessary to ask questions.
That
would be dangerous.
It also seems that we're like, as you were saying, this is largely where some states are moving to now. And we look at China as an example here, as where they control the information that comes into the country. They control the values that people have to approach new information, and they decide what they can and can't see, which may be fine for stability, but it's also an avenue for corruption and for perpetuation of a single party system that may not necessarily be in the benefit of the people that are being governed.
Yes, that's why I think at the end of the day, the question of values is fundamental. And I think in China, it's quite interesting to see the anti-corruption campaigns being launched because I think I'm not a specialist of China, so I have to speak carefully on that issue. But I think in those campaigns, there are some political goals to eliminate some people who challenge the groups in power. But I think there's something deeper than that. There is a sense that in a world which becomes valueless, greed can destroy everything. And so in some ways, this is the Achilles heel a Chinese system, because for a Communist Party just to perpetuate itself in power, it needs a set of values, and no society can live without a set of values. And if the value is just a negative value of preventing people from enriching themselves, that's not quite enough. You need more than that. And so when I talk about a competition of norms, I think you're going to see more and more debates around the world on what are the values that bring a society together. So all that technology, all that marvelous technology, I mean, I would like to be 20 years old because I think it's a fantastic age to live in. It's a kind of new renaissance. The internet has the same impact on the world that the printing press had during the Renaissance. So all that marvelous technology, it does not answer the question of why do we live, what do we live, what do we live for? And I think these questions are going to become more and more prominent because people will discover that a purely functional organization of the world does not answer some basic human needs. The Second Renaissance is full of promise, but it's also full of dangers. I mean, we forget that the First Renaissance was a time of wars that ended really with the Treaties of Westphalia. So it took 150 years to settle. And I think with the internet, with the new distribution of knowledge, with the new ways human communities are going to organize themselves, the foundation of legitimacy are going to change. So what is at stake is that you don't want that huge shift to be accompanied by wars at a time when nuclear weapons exist and other weapons of mass destruction are being developed in a way, because you could have bioweapons, you could have all sorts of horrible things that could spread total catastrophe, that could have catastrophic outcomes in the world. So I look at this age with trepidation, because I see it as something where new forms of political communities are going to be invented, and that's extremely exciting. But I think the transition from one type of legitimacy to the other carries with it enormous dangers, considering the existence of weapons of mass destruction. And that's why we have a duty to think through that transition, to manage it, to get the benefits and avoid the risks.
We're talking in roundabout ways about the balkanization of the internet as well, where you see internet sovereignty or information sovereignty. But to achieve that, you're necessarily going to have the balkanization of technology and technological manufacturer R&D and so on. And are we seeing something moving in that direction in the way that the world is approaching, say, Huawei, and we're seeing the decoupling of the economics of technology?
Yes, I think there was the illusion that the internet is just a conduit, that is just connectivity without content. And we are discovering that, and 5G is an illustration of that, that because software and hardware are intimately connected as we move to the next phase of internet connectivity, that it's a package. And so you are going to see and you see at a different level that the big internet companies, they were keen, not for legal reasons and practical reasons, not to be seen as content companies. And now all sorts of questions are raised on what kind of content they should stop, what kind of content they should allow. So the internet is moving to the phase where the distinction between content.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Content and conduit is shown to be false. And as soon as that is accepted and understood, then indeed the question about the risk of balkanization, the risk and the opportunities too, because they are, I mean, again, it's about different approaches to the world. But the a certain level of balkanization of the internet is likely. The question is whether that balkanization leads to a juxtaposition of bubbles that ignore each other, and that would be a very dangerous situation, or whether while you allow for different modus operandi in different parts of the world, you have enough connectivity between those different continents, so to speak, that they are not self-contained, that they continue to engage with each other. And that balance between openness and differentiation is going to be a big political and technical issue, I think, in the future.
I don't think that social media or filter bubbles are really just a question for the future. I think that these are issues that we're dealing with today. In today's world, how do you see public discourse or citizen opinion affecting the maneuvering of international politics and the way that great powers interact?
Well, I think what we see today is that the traditional distinction between domestic politics and international politics is disappearing, because no human community is a self-contained community. There are all sorts of links, connections that cut across borders, which maximize opportunities for influence, if one wants to spin it in a positive way, manipulation, if one wants to spin it in a negative way. And then when you combine that with the fact that social media help build tribes, where the logic of social media is that more and more you meet and you talk to the people who think like you, who react like you. So it's a great amplifier of your own sentiments. And so if you combine that with manipulation, you can see how you can feed into a tribe to reinforce that tribal sentiment through fake news, through a very systematic approach to that. And And that is, I think, a great risk for today's world, because it means that at this stage, the global internet, far from promoting a global conversation, really reinforces each tribe in its small tribe in its own convictions. And what I see, which I find striking, is that when you look at opinion movement, I mean, movement of opinion as they develop, you see that in the pre-social media era, you would have people organizing meetings, then demonstrations. It would be a painful slog where you could be ridiculed because you call for a demonstration and there are 50 people who show up and that doesn't look very good. And it's the end of the story. With the social media, it's like an underground river, so to speak. You can build your constituency gradually, virtually. And then once it has reached a certain critical size, it bursts out in the physical space where it's credible because it has reached that critical mass. So you can. So it's the combination of the virtual reality of social media where you build a group, and then you can influence with your physical presence through demonstration, a variety of actions on the ground, then you influence the physical space because we're still physical beings living in a physical space. And so you see there the enormous potential of social media in changing the dynamics of politics. And that's why we keep being surprised, because you have those underground rivers that are being gathering strengths in a very systematic way. They are organized by people who have understood how to manage that space. You don't see them. And one day they break out in the open. And they are very big, and they can really overwhelm you if you have not paid attention.
Yeah, it's a real evolution of what we saw in the Arab Spring, where the underground rivers wasn't the organization. The underground river was the discontent that was being felt across many different societies. And when that one spark lit a fire in a marketplace in Tunisia, that organization happened organically through the networks, through the technology that you're talking about now, where people are approaching it in a much more strategic way. I wanted to stick on the issue of great power competition and geopolitics. We're in a period of rising geopolitical tensions, with the main actors being the US, China, and Russia. Where is Europe located on this map of power, and how united is Europe as a geopolitical actor, and what role is it going to play over the next decade?
Well, if you look at Europe through traditional lenses of nation state and traditional federalism, Europe is a long way from acting as a single actor. But in some ways, Europe is ahead of its time in the sense that the Europe of tomorrow will not be a super state. It's not going to be the United States of America. It's not going to be a traditional federation. And I think in some areas it is already a superpower in, for instance, in norms, in imposing norms. And so I think the future of Europe is in inventing a new, precisely this new type of federalism that I'm convinced is the future of the world. I think the transition from the traditional political institutions to sort of postmodern institution is not an easy one, because what you see today is a reaction in Europe against sort of abstract institutions that are perceived as uncountable, as distant. And so you have all these nationalistic movements in Europe. The Italy of Salvini is an example. In a way, Brexit is an illustration of that. But at the same time, you have more and more people in Europe who understand that just breaking what has been built in Europe would be suicidal, that Europe has achieved a certain balance between market and social protection, and that the nice garden, in a way, that Europe is cannot survive if it doesn't have a power to influence the jungle around, so to speak. And so I think that That perception is gaining some ground. And the Europe of tomorrow will probably be a Europe of variable geometry, which will make progress in defense, which will continue to be a major power in trade, which will probably become a power in the development of norms on a number of emerging issues, whether it's artificial intelligence, privacy. I mean, you've seen the GDPR directive issued in Europe. I think this is these are areas where you're going to see Europe becoming stronger. Europe as a traditional political entity, I think in a way it missed the boat in 1989. It did not pursue traditional federal integration the way it would have been necessary for today be a strong power. But in the economic field, you'll probably see the euro becoming more and more an alternative currency to the dollar. It will take time, but the more the United States tries to weaponize the dollar as an instrument of diplomacy by cutting out countries, the more you're going to have countries which want alternative currencies to trade with. And so I think that will play in favor of the euro. And so if the Europeans on their side fill the gaps in the euro governance, including the need at some point for a euro budget, it's quite interesting that the departing head of the European Central Bank, Mario Draghi, who played a key role in saving the euro during the euro crisis in 2010-2015. Mario Draghi, as he prepares to leave the European Central Bank, said that you do need a European budget with some macroeconomic impact. It's a position that has been taken also by Macron in France. It's a position that is not supported by Germany at the moment because they see themselves as then bankrolling other Europeans. So there will have to be safeguards. But I think at some point we will move toward that. I don't think it's going to happen overnight, but I think 10 years from now, it will be the case.
So you mentioned the mistakes of 1989, which makes me assume when you're mentioning Europe now, that's not a Europe that includes Russia. Am I correct?
Yes. And I think in 1989, when we saw that Europe was entering a new phase, we did not look at Europe in a forward-looking way. At the time, and this was a perception not just of Mitterrand, but also of Chancellor Kohl, there was a sense, okay, Germany is going to be a much bigger country, more than 80 million people. So it's very important to tie Germany in the European, in the framework of European institutions. That was one of the reasons why not just France and other European countries, but Germany itself developed the euro as a way to ensure that Germany will be tied in broader institutions, broader European institutions. I think that made some sense, but it was too retrospective because nobody in Europe today believes that the problem is a balance between Germany and the other, that there's a risk of conflict, tensions between their differences of views. I mean, I just mentioned the differences of view on the budget. So I don't, not everything is hunky-dory, but the notion of intra-European conflict is just a notion of the past. And I believe that at the time, it would have been better to look at Europe in a forward-looking way as Europe, with the end of the Cold War, is no longer the strategic center of the world, as it was during the Cold War, even if it was not the main strategic actor, but that was the battlefield. It's no longer that. So Europe, if it wants to exist in a world in which it won't be the center anymore, has to really look not inward, but outward. And I think that was not done. And that was reflected in the policy vis-à-vis Russia.
And now when you say looking outward, Russia is not really one of the – it's one of the big players in the world that we're concerned about, but it's also on a bit of a downward trajectory in terms of economics and also demography and so on, where we're looking at China and its power trajectory and an emerging confrontation or at least tension with the US. Does the EU or Europe in general have a role to play amidst this tension between the US, or is that something that the EU is best just staying right the hell out of?
No, I think the EU has a role to play as a bridge builder. I think, to be honest, today it's very difficult to build bridges with Russia because Russia is in a weak position. It's a country that has not diversified its economy. It's a country that has not a great demography. And Putin knows it. So Russia often acts as a spoiler rather than a builder. And that's also a reaction to, I think, misguided policies in the immediate aftermath of the Cold War. I think the quick enlargement of NATO was could not be perceived as a good thing for Russia, even if there were efforts to show that NATO would become a friendly organization. But when you have been the military alliance to protect Western Europe from Russia, from the Soviet Union for decades, you don't turn that alliance into a friendly entity that easily. So I think there was a sense of humiliation, of threat by Russia. And Putin has given back the Russians a sense of pride. So that's why he is generally popular in Russia, although his popularity has been declining recently.
Does that make him more dangerous, or does that make him a spent power?
I think it's to consider Russia as a spent power is
more so Putin than Russia. Is Putin's declining popularity, does that make him more dangerous as a leader, or does that mean that we're starting to see change?
I hope that Putin will adjust his policies. I'm not sure he will, because he's better at politics than at strategic management. I think for Russia, when you look at the situation today, Russia has the ideal neighbor in its West. The Western Europeans, they have technology, they have money, they are peaceful, they have no imperial design. They are the perfect neighbor for Russia. China is there with a billion.3 or 0.4 people in the East. And Russia has is a huge empty territory in the East. And so the real strategic challenge for Russia is how it will handle China in the future. And for me, the strategic future of Russia is in a cooperative relationship with Europe. I think Russia, as part of the European Union, Russia is too big for that. It would not work. But we should have worked much harder to build a relationship where Russia, and that's part of the evolution of Russia the European Union, toward variable geometry. We should have worked, and we should work in the future for a system in which Russia has a privileged relationship with the European Union. I think today this is a bit of a theoretical proposal because Russia has broken the European order when it annexed Crimea through military means. I think it would have been what should have been done would have been a discussion between Russia and Ukraine on maybe a special status for Crimea. I mean, negotiating what was the future of Crimea, not creating a fait accompli. That's
not exactly in Putin's playbook, unfortunately.
No, not at all. And Putin has been very good and nimble at creating facts on the ground. He created facts on the ground in Ukraine. He created facts on the ground in Syria. He is not so good at concluding after that because in Ukraine, Donbass is an industrial ruin. And it's a liability rather than an asset.
A liability for Russia. So you're saying that the frozen conflict is not a benefit to Russia at all?
I think it's a benefit, a tactical benefit, in the sense that having a frozen conflict in Ukraine freezes the situation of Ukraine, and so ensures that Ukraine is not going to move very, very fast. Let's say to become closer to the European Union because of that frozen conflict. So in that sense, it benefits Russia. But in a more positive way, it's a liability because it prevents Russia from normalizing its relations with the European Union. And in practical terms, Russia doesn't get much from having indirect control over Ukraine. And when you look at Syria, there's a tactical benefits there for Russia, in the sense that it has asserted itself as a key actor in the Middle East, that the Middle East has to count on Russia. At the same time, Russia does not have the money to rebuild Syria. So the victory of Assad is a somewhat hollow victory. And again, you have a situation of immense human suffering in Syria, where Russia doesn't know exactly how it gets out of it. I think Russia now would like to get out of it, but then their Russian interest and Iranian interest are not identical. In some ways, Syria is more strategic for Iran than it is for Russia. And so for Iran, keeping the Syrian regime exactly as it is more important than it is for Russia, which might accept some evolutions, but does not have the capacity to push for those evolutions.
It's interesting that you've mentioned that Putin is not a great closer on his deals of conflict. When you look at the map, there seems to be a frozen conflict emerging in Syria. There's still frozen conflicts in places like Nagorno-Karabakh. There's also frozen conflict in Ossetia and Abkhazia in Georgia. Now he's got one on his border in the Donbass region with Ukraine. Some people would say that is actually his strategy, to keep those areas in place and keep movement around, and also keep that ability to destabilize these regions. Whereas you're saying, no, it's actually his weakness in being able to close these deals. And that brings up my final question of the pod. You come from the United Nations pedigree as well, and we look at the United Nations Security Council as the most potent part of the United Nations. It seems to be that there's a little bit of a narrower space for the United Nations to act within the world, especially when you have these issues like Syria or like these frozen conflicts throughout the world. And also, we might even throw in this emerging story of concentration camps in Xinjiang and massive human rights violations. Is that a failure of the UN? Does the UN have to go through changes given these failures, or is this just par for the course in the history of the world and multilateral organizations such as the UN?
Well, the UN didn't fix the Cold War, and the UN is not going to fix the relations between the superpowers of today. What is clear is that the space within which the Secretary General of the United Nations can operate is shrinking. At the time of the first of the Bush administration, W. Bush, in the early 2000s, China was not certainly not assertive as it is now. The Europeans were less inward-looking because they didn't have the crisis of Brexit. They didn't have all the issues that they have now. So the UN could count on a solid group. The UN Secretary General could count on a solid group of countries, of which Australia was a member, to support his agenda. I think today the Secretary General is a bit squeezed between the United States on one side and China on the other. And he needs more allies. And I think today it's very important that countries like Australia, like the members of the European Union, stick together to promote a multilateral agenda on the global issues where the UN could play a role. It's not Microsoft and Google who are going to solve all the problem of tomorrow. The UN must take the initiative, but it will not take the initiative on its own accord. You need the countries that see those issues as important to really help the Secretary General reclaim an international agenda. And at the moment, he's in a difficult position to do so because his space has shrunk dramatically.
Well, I have to say, a podcast that talks about the benefits of the balkanization of the internet and the failure of Putin as a closer is a winner of a podcast, in my opinion. So, Jean-Marie Guerneau, thanks very much for joining us today on the National Security Podcast.
Thank you.
And a big thanks to Jean-Marie Guerneau. I do suggest that you all look out for his coming book, whatever it may be titled. The working title is The Second Renaissance, and it looks at the coming trends around the world with culture, identity, technology, and politics, and how these trends may intersect and interact. And if you have any thoughts on any of the issues that we discussed today, is Vladimir Putin a strategist? Is he an opportunist? Does he deliberately create these frozen conflicts around the periphery of Russia, or is that his inability to close a deal, so to speak? How do you think that nations are going to evolve as time goes on, and how do you think that identity is going to manifest itself in the future? Is it going to be a nationalistic identity? Is it going to be a networked identity? Is it going to be a city-state identity, as Jean-Marie alluded to in the podcast? Love to hear from you on these things, and you can let us know how you feel by hitting us up on Twitter at Apps Policy Forum or at NatSecPod. You can join our Facebook group at Policy Forum Pod. You can send us an email to podcast@policyforum.net, and you can also write a review on whatever platform you pod with. We do take these reviews seriously. We do pay close attention to them. We would love to hear your thoughts on the pods and any kind of pod that you'd like to hear from us in the future. So thanks very much for listening today, and we'll speak to you on the next National Security Podcast.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.